This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, U.S. Senator Chris Coons of Delaware will be in studio. We'll discuss Iran, President Trump's impeachment trial, and take your calls and comments. Also, sacred harp or shape note singing has been around since the founding of the United States. It's seeing a real comeback, particularly among young people. But first, health officials in Philadelphia estimate the death toll from drug overdose last year is on pace to match that of 2018, at least 1,100 victims. And as the opioid crisis continues to rage, the nonprofit Safe House is anxious to get a supervised injection site up and running. The site would allow users to inject their own illicit drugs under medical supervision in an effort to prevent death and shepherd at least some to treatment. However, the site has been in limbo since a federal judge's ruling last October, which narrowly found it would not violate federal law. Safe House is now asking for a final judgment. WHYY's Nina Feldman is here to bring us the latest. Welcome back, Nina.
Hi, Mary.
So here we are 3 months later, and there has been little to no movement on this story. Let's review just a bit. U.S. District Judge Gerald McHugh was looking at something dubbed the Crack House Statute.
That's right. So the Crack House Statute, as it's called, is a particular section of the United States Controlled Substances Act, which says that it's illegal to maintain any property or space for the purpose of distributing, selling, using drugs. It was added to that Controlled Substances Act in the 1980s at the height of the crack epidemic and applied to crack houses. It's also been used to apply to raves or parties where, you know, most people were using ecstasy or drugs while dancing. So it has been applied in other contexts. But the U.S. attorney was trying to apply it here in February. U.S. Attorney William McSwain sued Safe House to prevent it from opening on these grounds, saying, listen, you want to open a space for people to inject illegal drugs? That's maintaining a space for the purpose of using illegal drugs. What there seems pretty straightforward. Well, Safe House argued, we're not maintaining this space for the purpose of using drugs. We're maintaining this space for the purpose of saving lives. The people would be using the drugs anyway, essentially, and what they are doing here is using them with medical professionals standing by with the opioid overdose reversal drug Narcan to be able to reverse the overdose if it should occur.
So Judge McHugh essentially agreed with Safe House, but the decision, again, was narrow. And even though, you know, Safe House and its advocates celebrated at the time back in October, the decision was not enough to greenlight the site.
That's right. The judge ruled specifically on the language of that particular statute, which is what the U.S. attorney had requested he do. The U.S. attorney was confident enough that this would break that law that he said, let's just rule on what we have. Let's rule on the letter of the law. Based on that, we think we can win. They didn't win. And so now we're sort of back to the drawing board in this particular case to a certain degree, where Safe House still needs a final judgment if they were to have legal approval to open up.
Called a declaratory judgment, right? What does that do exactly?
That would essentially just close this case. It would be a judge's ruling that said, you know, in addition to ruling on the letter of this particular law, I'm saying here, Safe House, you have the go-ahead to go. This is a legal operation, and, you know, you can use this to protect yourself, at least from the standpoint of federal law. This is a sanctioned legal site from the standpoint of that judge, would be what they're asking for in a declaratory judgment, which is the paperwork that they filed in federal court last week.
So if Judge McHugh gives Safe House what it wants in this declaratory judgment, have we had any indication as to what U.S. Attorney William McSwain will then do as his next move?
Yeah, so he has pretty adamantly vowed to appeal. Immediately after the judgment back in October came through, he sent a letter to Safe House's legal team, making it very clear that he planned to appeal in the Third Circuit, and also threatening to the Safe House's team that if they were to open pending any sort of appeal process, he would use all the enforcement mechanisms at his disposal to stop them.
All right, Nina Feldman. So let's get into that just a little bit. Fair to say the folks who run Safe House are getting impatient. Again, the opioid crisis continues to, it's still explosive. There are an awful lot of people who are succumbing to overdoses. They want to get the thing up and running. Does it seem as if they might move while the appeals process is ongoing, as McSwain has indicated he thinks they might do?
Yeah, I mean, the attitude from Safe House's board and legal team is that's not a reasonable thing to ask of us. We would never say to you as a prosecutor, you know, you want to press charges against our client, this defendant, but we ask for you to wait to punish him until we've appealed and there's been a ruling granted on the appeal. That's not how it works. You know, we if there's a ruling, you can sort of act based on the ruling. And if there's an appeal, well, then we'll stop then. Now, the U.S. attorney could, ask for a stay from the judge, which would say, you know, even though there is this ruling on the ground that says Safe House could open, yeah, we're asking for a stay in the interim while appeals go mm-hmm. through. And if there was an official stay granted, well, that would be a different story. But you know, the Safe House essentially, I think, barring that, would want to get started as soon as possible.
Yeah. So if they did decide to go ahead and open, despite the fact that there's an appeal, as you indicated earlier, McSwain says he's going to go after them. Is there any indication as to what he might do to shut them down?
Well, in that letter that he sent to Safe House's legal team, he mentioned, you know, even if there is a even if there is a ruling that makes this property legal, the use of heroin, the possession of heroin, the sale of heroin or fentanyl in this case most of the time is not legal, and nothing about this ruling will change that. So there's sort of a lot of enforcement mechanisms at his disposal.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think Safe House's response to that would be, you're not going after individual people who possess or use heroin right now. For the most part, you're not really going after people who are selling heroin right now. So it would be strange if Safe House opened and all of a sudden you started to do that. And I think that would also rely a lot on the cooperation of local law enforcement.
Where are we with that? How does the Kenney administration view all this? Has Mayor Kenney indicated?
He hasn't weighed in since this sort of in this latest iteration of the debate. But he did just last week mention that he still continues to support overdose prevention sites or safe consumption sites like the one Safe House is proposing, and has come out in support of this effort overall. So I think it would be hard to imagine a ramped up law enforcement effort against people using drugs coming from the Kenney administration, given that express support. Yeah.
This is all conjecture, of course. You know, so is this thing imagining how this might unfold? So Rhonda Goldfein is on the Safe House board. She says Safe House is in the process of readying multiple locations, Nina Feldman. Do we know where these locations are? I'd have to guess one would probably be in Kensington, which has been ground zero of much of the crisis in the Philadelphia area.
I think that's a fair guess. There has also been a lot of conversation, especially in the face of sort of NIMBYism, not in my backyard conversations, where people say, well, you know, people from Kensington say, well, if you think this is such a good idea, why don't you ask for one down in South Philly or in other parts of the city? To which the board members of Safe House say, well, yeah, we do think that these should be in all parts of the city. We do think that this should be something that's available all over. So I don't think it's impossible that Safe House would be eyeing locations outside of Kensington as well.
And as we've reported, it is, you know, it's a real crisis in other areas of the city.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is just conjecture at this point. But I do think looking around the city is wise in thinking about where they might be.
You've covered this extensively, this story for WHYY. And yes, there's the NIMBY question, but there are also people in areas like Kensington who say, yeah, it's a good idea because it's been so bad here.
Right. I think you have some people who are saying, listen, we've suffered from a lack of neighborhood investment from the city, from government for decades. And now the first thing you're going to do to really pay attention to us is support and secure something that would all but keep the drug activity right here in our neighborhood and the violence that can sometimes go along with that. That's the sort of NIMBY argument. The other argument is this is happening every single day.
Sure.
There are people using outside on the street. There are people dying outside on the street.
And you kids know, walking by this on the way to school.
And if they're going to be there and they're going to be doing it, then they might as well be doing it safely and they might as well be doing it inside. So I think that's the other sort of neighborhood and resident attitude. And you hear, personally in my own reporting, I've heard more and more people coming around to that.
And again, back to just the fact that Rhonda Goldfein has indicated that Safe House is in the process of, quote, readying multiple locations. We don't know what readying means, do we? We don't know if Safe House has actually gotten a hold of certain properties. Not at this point. That hasn't been revealed.
We don't know. I think initially there was this focus on Safe House needing to buy or rent an entirely new property. And so that was sparking a lot of fear among neighbors in the immediate area of wherever that property could potentially be. And it was a lot of speculation. Where are they going to set up? I do wonder, and again, this is all speculation, that if they get a sort of legal go-ahead, they might be less worried about some of the property seizure that they had been worried about before that would have prevented them from co-locating with an existing organization. Yeah. And maybe they would just go and set up shop in a place where people already use drugs and, you know, they already have some of the infrastructure in place to get something going. So I think that a legal ruling would really open up the door for the possibilities of the types of places that they could set up. And it might not mean buying a brand new property or leasing a brand new property. But again, I'm guessing. We don't know. They're not ready to talk about it. We just know that they are sort of chomping at the bit and ready to get going as soon as the ruling's in.
And we don't know if there's a court timeline for that ruling. There's no indication.
No. So we know that the U.S. attorney is planning to file a response in federal court to that request for declaratory judgment. Okay. That should happen sometime this week. And presumably the judge would rule after that. And he did indicate, the judge, in the hearing in October, that he recognizes that there is a sense of urgency surrounding this issue.
Sure.
He made a couple of comments in court that sort of acknowledged the death toll climbs every day. Something like this isn't open.
Yeah. And again, as we said at the beginning, and you've written, there were 1,116 deaths from drug overdose in Philadelphia in 2018. And indications are 2019 will keep pace.
Yeah, there aren't official numbers yet to look at the full year of 2019, but based on the first couple of quarters, that's what health officials are predicting. So that's almost three people a day dying of an overdose in Philadelphia. So you can sort of, if those people are your friends or loved ones, you can sort of understand a sense of urgency if you really believe that a site like this would save those people's lives.
Yeah. Sobering news. We'll catch up to you as this story unfolds. WHYY's Nina Feldman, who reports on the opioid crisis for WHYY. Thanks.
Thank you.
Up next, U.S. Senator Chris Coons of Delaware is in studio with us to talk about a range of topics, including the impeachment proceedings and the crises in Iran and Iraq. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It has been a tumultuous start to the new decade, with headlines including the killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, Iran's firing of ballistic missiles, the deadly crash of a Ukrainian jetliner, and of course, ongoing developments in the impeachment trial of President Trump. We thought we'd take a close look at these issues with U.S. Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. He sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and is in studio with us this morning. Good to have you with us again.
Great to be back with you.
All right. And as always, the number to call in is 888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Senator Coons, let's get started with the impeachment trial. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of course, has delayed sending the articles of impeachment over, but has indicated she's likely going to do so this week. And so the trial of President Trump in the Senate could actually get underway this week. And my understanding is it is likely to look very much like that of President Bill Clinton back in 1999. Is that your understanding as well?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the question over witnesses and new documents. Democratic leaders, of course, in the Senate say they should be allowed. We also have several GOP senators, including Susan Collins and Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski, who are in agreement and I think are actively working to try to get this piece of the trial, this included into the trial. Again, tell us what the necessity is.
So broadly speaking, witnesses have trials. Yeah. Cover-ups don't.
Yeah.
There are several individuals who've said they are willing to come forward and testify. There's been evidence that's come forward or been developed in the last couple of weeks since the House voted out two articles of impeachment. Both a suggestion that there are emails that were not previously disclosed that would be relevant, and a list of four witnesses that Senator Schumer, Minority Leader Schumer, put forward several weeks ago now, saying here are four individuals, and Secretary Pompeo and former National Security Advisor John Bolton are the best known of those four. These are four individuals who were in the room, who were on the emails, who could give in-person, relevant, timely testimony to what President Trump did or didn't do. President Trump several weeks ago was saying, oh, of course, I think they should testify. Now this weekend he was saying, well, no, absolutely not. I need to protect the institution of the presidency. Let me speak to that briefly, if I might. Executive privilege doesn't create a get out of appearing free card. It is a privilege that exists and has been exerted by previous presidents. But if the president is trying to clear his reputation through the Senate trial, why wouldn't he want a former national security advisor who is volunteering to testify to appear? Why wouldn't he want a trial in which folks who were in the room and could testify to what actually happened under oath, which they didn't do in the House, could appear and then help clear his name? So I've had that conversation with a number of colleagues. President Trump seems to be very eager to be, quote unquote, exonerated in the Senate. That only happens when you have a full and fair trial. President Clinton and President Nixon directed their closest advisors and senior cabinet officials to cooperate with impeachment inquiries. President Trump directed all of them not to. Several senior administration officials appeared and testified in front of the House Intelligence Committee over the objections of the administration. There were two impeachment articles voted out of the House. The second article has to do with obstruction of Congress because Trump refused to allow relevant witnesses to testify and relevant documents to be produced. So if folks are following this closely, what will likely happen this week is mostly the preparation for a trial.
Sure.
The period when we get impaneled as the equivalent of a jury where the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court will come, the House managers will come over, they will present the articles. But then there's a several-day-long period for the president to prepare and deliver his briefs explaining his defense, and then for the House managers to reply. This is what happens in a typical criminal trial. After the indictment is presented, there's a period for the attorneys for both sides to present briefs. So we probably will not be sitting as a Senate hearing the arguments of the House managers for another full week.
Okay. Characterize the relevance of this trial should there be no witnesses.
Well, given that the president blocked the most critical witnesses from testifying in front of the House, it will be hard for us to have a fair and open trial. The House worked very hard to develop a detailed accounting of what happened in the administration. Just to remind your listeners, President Trump's accused of having conducted a shakedown of a close allied country of Ukraine, which has been under pressure for years from separatists who are trained and funded by the Russians. And he dangled $400 million in congressionally appropriated military assistance to Ukraine on the condition that they do him a favor of opening an investigation without foundation into his strongest potential rival in the 2020 campaign, former Vice President Joe Biden. That's really a fairly striking abuse of power, if true. And it is the first time that there's been a president impeached over an abuse of office that involved national security and foreign policy conduct of this type. And part of the pressure that I believe the House managers felt to proceed, even when they weren't able to compel the testimony of key witnesses, was that what the president's accused of doing is interfering in our 2020 election,
sure,
which is now just a few months away.
You expressed concern. You have expressed concern about the fallout should there be an acquittal in the Senate that the president will be, quote, unbounded. What does that mean?
Well, the constitutional remedy for a president abusing his power or acting outside of his scope of authority is impeachment, ultimately. That's what the Constitution provides. President Trump, after this impeachment inquiry began, walked out on the front drive of the White House and challenged China to do what they could to dig up dirt on his political rival. I'll remind you that candidate Trump in 2016 famously said at a rally, "Russia, if you're listening, see if you can find Hillary Clinton's emails." And evidence shows that it was literally that day that Russian military intelligence began attempting to hack into Hillary Clinton's email server. So the idea that we have a president who is so either callous to or cavalier about foreign interference in our elections is fairly disturbing to me. And if he believes it will help him win the election and he believes that he's been cleared or exonerated in the Senate because an impeachment trial results in a straight line party vote and he is not convicted, not removed, I'm gravely concerned that our 2020 election is at real risk.
Chris Coons, are you concerned the impeachment process might come back to hurt Democrats in swing districts this election year?
Well, the recent polls in states where there are closely contested Senate races show that the overwhelming majority of Americans want a fair trial, and that includes wanting to see relevant witnesses and testimony. Impeachment has been a very contentious issue. Folks who are loyal Trump supporters strongly oppose impeachment, and I've heard from quite a few of them in Delaware. A broader range of citizens in Delaware strongly support the impeachment, and I've heard from even more of those. So I get regular input from Delawareans, and it's running about 60-40 in favor of impeachment, the emails and letters and phone calls to my office. But it's not 90-10.
Well, if it were to affect Democrats in a negative way in the fall, it will still have been worth it, I'm assuming. I'm putting words into your mouth, but it could be devastating.
I'll remind you that Speaker Pelosi resisted calls for an impeachment inquiry for months from some elements of her caucus in the House. And it was only once President Trump's effort with regards to Ukraine was exposed by a whistleblower and then confirmed that she began saying it's time for an impeachment inquiry. We have to. It is our constitutional obligation. So I don't think Speaker Pelosi either took this on as a partisan gambit or took any joy in this. I think she saw it really as her solemn obligation under the Constitution to begin the inquiry.
The death of Qasem Soleimani just over a week ago. Is the world, are Americans safer with him dead?
Well, there's no doubt that Qasem Soleimani and the Quds Force, which he commanded, was Iran's most lethal military arm. And General Soleimani's role in organizing, funding, directing, inspiring their network of proxies around the region, from Hezbollah to Hamas to the Houthis in Yemen, made him a quite effective and lethal leader. He's tied to attacks on American troops that may have killed as many as 600 Americans in the war in Iraq, as well as incidents in Afghanistan. So this is not a good guy. And having Qasem Soleimani gone from this earth is, I think, undeniably a good thing for the United States and our interests. But to get a full accounting of what this means, you have to look at the consequences. I don't believe that Iran is done with their retaliation or counterattack. I think their next step may well happen in a time and place that we have difficulty predicting or defending against.
Cyberspace is a big fear.
They are a particularly able cyber activator, actor. They're a particularly capable cyber actor. They also have this network of proxies, not just in the immediate region, but of also agents throughout the world. They have carried out lethal attacks in countries as diverse as Bulgaria and Argentina over the last 20 years. So first, I don't think we've seen the last of this. Second, General Soleimani may achieve in his death what he couldn't achieve in his life, which was one of his principal goals, was getting the United States expelled from Iraq to create a broader range of operation for Iran in Iraq. And as you saw, the vote of the parliament and the statement by the prime minister suggest that Iraq is moving towards expelling all American troops. That would harm our work against ISIS. It would leave Iraq much more heavily under the influence of Iran. And I think in terms of our immediate short-term regional goals, would be harmful. So,
well, then was the timing, in your opinion, of the killing of Soleimani not correct, not right?
Well, there's two components to that, I think. You know, there was reporting today by NBC that President Trump had authorized the killing of Soleimani months ago. And we had a very contentious classified briefing last week that lasted just over an hour. It was about 75 minutes, where 100 senators were present. And the whole senior national security team from the administration came. And they gave us very little in the way of details, virtually nothing, other than asserting that they had credible intelligence that there was an imminent threat. President Trump told Laura Ingraham on Fox on cable more than he told the Senate. There was no mention of there being a credible specific threat to bomb four embassies, for example, something which his own Secretary of Defense, Secretary Esper, in an interview over this past weekend also said he hadn't really heard.
So it's really tough to determine whether this killing was timely.
Timely,
that's what I'm hearing.
If what you're really asking me is,
in terms of whether there was a specific threat.
Was there an imminent threat that
mm-hmm.
the president in his commander-in-chief role has the authority to act? Correct. I think that's very debatable. The real issue that I tried to raise in that briefing, and I've now has been reported, and so I'm now speaking to, is, look, there's a spectrum, there's a continuum of events. Let's say the president gets credible intelligence that there really is an imminent threat to American diplomats or troops overseas at an American base. Yes, as commander-in-chief, Article 2 of the Constitution, he has the power and the authority, even the responsibility, to act to protect Americans overseas. But in a fact pattern that is very slow evolving, where it is entirely predictable months in advance that actions that the president and his national security team are taking may well lead to war, of course, I said, you have to agree that you would have to come seek authorization from Congress. And the refusal to agree to that was what produced bipartisan uproar in that briefing and the abrupt ending of the briefing. Mm-hmm. If we know right now that President Trump has said publicly, Iran will not have a nuclear weapon while I'm president. And as a result of this strike on Soleimani and other developments, our leaving the Iran deal, Iran's leadership has now said they're going to abandon restraints on their enrichment. They're going to renew nuclear enrichment. It's pretty predictable that at some point in the next 6 months to a year, the national security team will come to the president and say, Iran is close to reaching a threshold where we have to take action. My point, privately and now publicly, is you have to seek authorization from Congress for that kind of action. We're a democracy. We have to have a debate about this. We can't just march to a new forever war in the Middle East without the public being engaged.
So let's get to the War Powers Resolution, which was approved by the House last week, which would aim to limit President Trump's military actions against Iran. There would need to be authorization from Congress. Is there enough support to get this through the Senate?
I'm a co-sponsor of Senator Tim Kaine's resolution in the Senate. I think it will get through just narrowly. I think it'll get 51-52 votes. The administration is lobbying very hard against it. That would send it to the president's desk, but he will veto it. And I don't think there's a chance we'll get enough Republican support for it to survive a veto. I'm not trying to weaken our troops in the field. I'm trying to demonstrate the power of a democracy, which is that we actually should have a debate about these things before launching into another conflict. And that also means members of Congress have to be responsible and accountable for being engaged and for putting forward what we believe would be a strategy that would keep us safer and make us a more responsible actor in the region and the world.
You are co-sponsoring legislation to provide nearly $3.5 billion in aid annually to Israel. Republican Senator Marco Rubio is partnering with you on this. Why now?
There was a MOU signed between the Obama administration and the government of Israel. This is simply authorizing that MOU. So our current appropriations are at this level. They have been for several years following the Obama-Netanyahu MOU. But I think it's important that Congress authorize it, that we actually have a vote on the floor of the Senate saying we are aware of and support this level of security cooperation between the United States and Israel.
What are we hearing from Israel about the crisis in Iran?
I personally have heard nothing in the last week, but I would expect that our administration and their administration are coordinating regularly. I'll remind you, Prime Minister Netanyahu is in an uncertain period. He is the subject of criminal investigations by their attorney general, and I believe is facing an indictment and is asking the Knesset to enact a law that would shield him from that. And there's upcoming elections, I think, the 3rd of March.
The White House is considering expanding its travel ban to additional countries. And so tell us about the No Ban Act, which you are co-sponsoring.
So the No Ban Act is a bipartisan – excuse me, it is not a bipartisan attempt. It is a Democrats-only attempt at enacting a statute in Congress that would amend our underlying immigration laws in a way that would invalidate the Supreme Court's opinion that upheld the third version of President Trump's travel ban. I'll remind you, as candidate Trump, President Trump said that he would ban Muslims from coming to our country. One of his first executive orders early in 2011 as president enacted a travel ban on countries, on individuals coming from majority Muslim countries. That was invalidated by a court. He took a second try. That was invalidated by a court. He took a third try. That one was ultimately upheld by the Supreme Court because it contained within it an exemption process or a way that you could apply and seek a waiver. That waiver process in reality has been a complete fiction. There are thousands of American citizen families divided where there is a husband and a spouse, a parent and a child, an ailing grandparent who are stuck in countries from Yemen to Iran because of this travel ban.
And very quickly, we only have a couple seconds left. Where is the No Ban Act in the congressional process?
It's in the House. I am hoping it has had a hearing. I'm hoping it will have a markup and a vote on the floor. This is building support for a bill that I hope could become law in the next Congress.
U.S. Senator Chris Coons, always a pleasure. Thank you. Up next on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, we learn about one of the oldest forms of American music, sacred harp singing. Keep it here.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. You are listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY. It's a song from the Sacred Harp Songbook, apparently called Exhortation. And I'm told that the music clip we just heard doesn't do justice to actually participating in and hearing sacred harp singing live. Sacred harp singing, also known as shape note singing, has been in existence in this country for centuries. The concept is beautifully simple. It's communal. The musical structure is relatively uncomplicated. Anyone can participate, and many who do say it can be transformational. We're joined now by Thomas Ward, himself a shape note singer and organizer of the forthcoming Keystone Sacred Harp Convention. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
I must be living in a bubble because when our producer, John Ahrens, pitched this as a show idea, I'd never heard of it. But it is among the oldest forms of music in this country, and it is enjoying quite a revival.
It definitely is. And it's funny that you should describe your experience that way, because that was kind of my experience of it. It was sort of on my radar for a long time. I kind of vaguely knew about it, but I had no idea that it was this living tradition. And I actually had a CD with some shape note music on it, and I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. I wonder if people still sing this? And I Googled it, and lo and behold, on my block, there was a regular singing that week. And so I just went along and kind of never turned back.
So you walked in the door, mm-hmm. and you saw people singing, and you were probably welcomed in. My understanding mm-hmm. is that this is just, it's an open arms type of gathering.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
whether you can really sing well or not, right?
Yeah. In fact, some would say that singing well is not necessarily a good thing in the traditional sense. I think a lot of the way that we sing goes against a lot of what people who are classically trained might be told to do. It's not about making a pretty sound. It's about being involved and participating. So yes, we say that no experience is necessary. There are no performances, no rehearsals, and no judgment, as one of our singers said to me yesterday, actually, at singing.
So. And yet, when I've heard clips, it does sound good.
Oh, well, that's good. Nice to say. Nice to hear. Yeah.
Let's talk about how this works. Shape notes.
Yes.
Help us to visualize mm-hmm. what this is if we are looking at the songbook.
Right. So shape note, the phrase shape note refers to, in fact, a printing convention. And it's actually, there's some debate about when this convention was invented, but one account puts it in Philadelphia around 1800. And it's a style of printing music in four-part harmony that is aimed to help people who don't have training in reading music.
Okay.
And so if you can picture a score of music with the sort of round, most traditional music has round note heads.
But like a little flag on top.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But with shape note music, the note heads are different shapes. They're actually four different shapes.
Triangle.
Yes, a triangle, a square, a circle, and a diamond. And it's a little bit, it's slightly complicated to explain, but basically those shapes refer to steps on the scale. So it's meant to sort of help people be able to pick up music and sight read it very quickly without having to have intense training. And that is actually, it's interesting, people who have absolutely no background in reading music often pick it up more easily, whereas I actually came to it having had experience in singing choir and playing the piano, and I sort of had to learn how to incorporate this new piece of information, which is the shapes, you know, into my reading of the music.
How does the actual group singing work? There's no conductor.
That's right.
There's no audience.
Mm-hmm.
There are no instruments.
Right.
So what are the mechanics there?
Yeah, or you could put it the other way, that we are all of those things.
You are everything.
Right? Yeah, so... Okay. So we sit in a square, we face each other, you've got the basses on one side, the sopranos, who we actually call trebles, on facing them, and then on the other two sides of the square, the tenors and the altos. And we face each other, and usually what happens is we take turns, people just pick a song and say, I'd like to hear, you know, number 33 on the bottom of the page, and everyone opens the book, and we sing that song, and if we get it right, we get it right.
There is a leader.
There is a leader, yes.
And you kind of rotate that out.
Exactly.
Right?
And that person stands in the middle of the square. And usually the way it works is he or she waves their arm and kind of to keep time in a sort of simple way. And actually, people in the square will follow along also waving their arms to keep time. But people sometimes who come not having been before are sort of wondering what's going on. Why is everyone waving their arms around?
It's called beating time, I read.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it's just to keep everyone kind of together. We sing for ourselves, and you know, sometimes people ask me, oh, when do you perform? And we don't perform. We just get together and sing mm-hmm. together.
What is the Sacred Harp Songbook? Because this is at the heart of much of this.
That's right. So the Sacred Harp Songbook was first published in, I think, around 1844 and has been updated continually since then. The most recent edition, which is the one that we sing out of, is from 1991. But it really is just the most popular shape note book. There are others. There's one called the Shenandoah Harmony, which is a newer one that was actually put together by some people who also sing in Philadelphia. And then, you know, there are also other shape traditions. So we ours is a four shape tradition, and there's also a seven shape tradition, which is it's the same principle. It's just the shapes correspond to the scale steps in a slightly different way.
I'd like to get to a clip in just a moment, sure. But first, you know, there are Christian roots definitely to the sacred harp music, but all are welcome.
That's right. Yeah.
Just to clarify.
That's right. And so another thing, if you were to show up at a singing. The music is largely Christian, but people from all sorts of backgrounds come. A lot of people who are entirely secular. It's not about proselytizing or faith in that way. So I think that's an important thing to
clarify.
We'll
talk about the experience in just a moment. But because sacred harp singing is sung by so many singers, sitting in the round, it is known as difficult to record. Properly, one of the best attempts at a professional sacred harp recording was made for the 2003 Civil War movie Cold Mountain. Here is that recording of the song Idumea, credited simply to the sacred harp singers. Sensation of being inside something like this, Thomas Ward, when you are in a group singing this music? How can you describe it?
I can try. And I mean, I should say it's very different for different people. Some people connect very much to the words. For some people, the words are not that important. It's the music. I think it may be fair to say that the community is a huge part of it. The feeling that you're with a group of people, whether it's a very small group. I mean, that was quite a large group that was singing, and often the groups are very large, especially at that big sort of convention type situations. But it's, yeah, I think a feeling of belonging to a group and creating something together as a group that isn't for sale. It isn't for other people. It isn't not for other people. It's just we're doing it together, and it's not we're not doing it as a performance. We're just kind of doing it for each other.
It sounds as if it can be transporting. That's what I was looking
for. Yeah, yeah. It absolutely can. I mean, there sometimes is a sense that you sort of you blend into the crowd, and you really. I've been in situations where we'll all kind of start singing a song, and as a group, we kind of make a decision to sing it in one way or another, and it's not necessarily the leader who's making that decision. We're all.
You just kind of go with the flow as a group. Mm-hmm. You're making a decision. You sense it from your fellow singers.
Yes, or the collective mind kind of takes over, and I think that's it's not about being. A performer in that way, and it can be very transporting, and sometimes it can take you by surprise. You'll be singing a song that you've sung 100 times, and the words will suddenly say something new to you that you had never experienced before. So
let's talk about some of the common themes of the lyrics. Mortality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Is a big one.
Yes.
I mean, some of these lyrics were written like a few centuries ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was much closer to people back then than perhaps it is in today's culture.
Absolutely. That clip that you just played, I mean, the lyrics are, "And am I born to die and lay this body down? And must my trembling spirit fly into a world unknown?" Which I think for a lot of, you know, people that very explicit sort of discussion of death, which occurs in the lyrics, can be troubling and surprising and alarming. But I think that is also one of the things that a lot of people who sing kind of connect to. I should say it's not all, you know, dark and scary, you know,
sure,
sort of things like that. But that is an element of the lyrics.
So there was a revival of this music genre. I think it was in New England in the late 60s, which was characterized then by a cultural exchange with the South, which is where these – are they all called singings? That's generally when you get together, it's called a singing?
A singing, yes.
Okay. And I've read that Southern singings are considered to be a bucket list item for many people. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, for a lot of people, you know, again, lots of people have very different relationships to this music. And I came to it about 9 or 10 years ago. And so I wasn't, you know, part of that. I mean, people who were doing that revival in the 60s, you know, that was before I was born. And so they would be able to speak more to what that was like. I think there among some singers, there is a sense that the South is kind of where it is the authentic. But I think that a lot of people have also kind of begun to, you know, try to nuance that idea, because after all, a lot of the music actually comes from New England in the first place. And I mean, the thing about this also that should be said is it brings together a lot of different strands and traditions. And so there's the sort of Southern strand, there's a New England strand, you know, there's older music, there's more modern music. Music is continuing to be written actually for the tradition. So there are, you know, active composers who are still writing this kind of music that they bring to singings and try them out at singings.
Now, and if you look at a group of people in a singing, mm-hmm, you'll find a fascinating bunch of different types of folks from all walks of life. Tell us about that.
That's right. And I mean, that's
Describe a singing for us.
Sure. I mean, you'll see the kind of tattooed, you know, pierced city folk, and some, you know, we have some plainclothes people, sort of Amish and River Brethren type people who sometimes come to singings, older, younger. So it is a really interesting range. In fact, one thing that strikes a lot of people is just how, you know, there are all these like young people who seem very like kind of punky people. Like, what are they doing singing this apparently very religious music? It's
what do you think they're doing there?
You know,
people in there say they're 20s and, you know, maybe early 30s.
I think it depends on who you ask, and I wouldn't want to speak for those people.
Sure.
I mean, I think I've heard from some people that it's about connecting. I think a lot of it is for a lot of younger people, it's a kind of anti-commercialist sort of thing as well, because I mean, you can buy recordings of it, but I mean, there's an old joke that you might drive for 5 hours to sing in a Sacred Harp singing, but you wouldn't cross the street to just listen to it or pay to go. You'd never pay to go to a performance, you know? And so it's not
about the experience of being inside.
Exactly. It's not about producing a product in that sense. And I think that appeals to a lot of people who are sort of tired of the kind of commercialization of music.
Okay. We've only got about 30 seconds left. There is a convention ahead.
That's right. So the Keystone Convention, which is an annual convention, it's on the 24th and 25th of this month, January, and it's at the Rotunda, which is a space at 4014 Walnut Street. Anyone is welcome. It's free. Just show up. It's from 10 to 3:30. People come in and out. If you want to find out more, phillysacredharp.org is a website where you can find out about the singings.
And again, that's the weekend of the 25th at the Rotunda in Philadelphia.
That's right.
Thomas Ward, it was so great to have you with us. What a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Have fun.
Thank you.
Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I am Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you with us for Radio Times. Be sure to join us tomorrow for the next Radio Times show.